Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck, buddies? What the fucksters? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my show, WTF, the podcast. Welcome to it. How is everybody? How's your Monday going so far? How can I help you? Is everything okay at this table? Do you need anything? Would you like me to refill that for you? Before I start talking about myself or whatever ridiculousness is in my head, I'd just like to acknowledge and express my sadness over the passing of Kevin Meaney, who was a very, very funny guy, a great comic, a real original, and just purely entertaining. And I used to see him a lot in Boston. When I started out, there was actually a night, it might have been at Stitches, the Sweeney and Meaney show with Steve Sweeney and Kevin Meaney. I believe he started there, so I got to see him a lot. And he was just a completely entertaining guy, and he died, I believe he was 60, which is too young. I don't know the situation or the conditions surrounding it, but I just wanted to acknowledge the fact that we lost a really funny man. So rest in peace, Kevin Meaney. And we know you don't care. That was a bit he did. All right. Sarah Jessica Parker is on the show today. I did this interview in New York City in a hotel room. And I watched a few episodes of Sex and the City. I like it, but I like her. She's one of those people that's just present in the media landscape. She is a shining star, and I always liked her. I every time I saw her in anything, and she's been doing a lot of stuff for a long time, even more than I knew, you relate to her somehow. You just sort of like, I like that lady. She seems nice and sweet and charming and full of energy and talent, and I don't know what I would say to her if I saw her. I still get that feeling. I get that feeling every time I have to do an interview. But it always makes it a little awkward when I got to do it in my hotel room, because the hotel rooms at the Bowery where I stay, usually I don't spend the big jack for the bigger suite. They're sort of a small room. So it's just basically a bedroom. And I always have to clean up and tidy up and have the cleaning person come in early, so at least it doesn't look sordid somehow. Just come on in. That's a washcloth. I'm sorry, there are towels on the floor. It was just one of those things where I'm already entering it a little self-conscious and a little embarrassed, because it is not your standard professional interview situation. But I found her to be very charming. She lived up to everything I expected, and I loved talking to her. And you will enjoy it too in a minute. The schedule is, I will be with my partner, my business partner and producer, Brendan McDonald, at the Now Hear This Festival in Anaheim, California. We're doing a live interactive WTF event. There are about 30 other podcasts doing shows all weekend. That's this Saturday. Now Hear This Festival. You can go to nowhearthisfest.com for all the details and come out. I haven't seen Brendan in a while. He's coming out this week. Carnegie Hall, there's about 100 tickets left, and that's November 4th in New York City. James K. Polk Theater, November 19th in Nashville, Tennessee. The Vic Theater, Chicago, Illinois, December 3rd for two shows. Ruby Diamond Concert Hall, Tallahassee, Florida, January 24th, 2017. The Carolina Theater in Durham, North Carolina, February 17th. Knight Theater, Charlotte, North Carolina, February 18th. The Ridgefield Playhouse, March 2nd. Ridgefield, Connecticut. The Music Hall in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, March 3rd. College Street Music Hall, March 10th in New Haven, Connecticut. Troy Savings Bank Music Hall, March 11th in Troy, New York. And Flynn Center in Burlington, Vermont, March 12th. There you go. If you heard your city or it's nearby, go grab a ticket, would you? I watched my new kitten, Buster Kitten, continually bully the old man monkey, which upsets me, and there's nothing I can do about it. But there is something I can do about it, and it's something that I'm procrastinating on. because I don't know why I'm projecting or transposing or what, but I'm having a hard time accepting the fact that I'm going to have to cut this cat's balls off. Obviously, I'm not going to do it at home. Obviously, I'm going to take him to a professional to have it done. But I don't know if it's a weird pride, but I got this cat when it was a little teeny kitten. It was 2 months old. He's doing all right. He's a little crazy. I don't have a full grasp, and I don't think he does either, of what his personality is going to end up being, because what I'm about to do is going to have a big impact on that. But he's grown in these nice balls. He doesn't know that he did, but he's done a good job with the balls. And now I'm just going to take him in and have his balls cut off because it's the right thing to do. And I'm procrastinating because I don't know. It must be transference. I'm personalizing it. I'm using empathy that is human to try to think about what it would be like to be young and just coming into my own and having someone put me into a cage, which I thought would be fun initially, and then cut my balls off. I think I just explained a job, that it's a metaphor for a job. But no, but I have to do this. And it's going to be the right thing to do. But am I going to be able to look my cat in the eye again after I do that to him? He's going to know. I've been through this with other cats, but it's been a while. It's been a while since I had to sort of be the guy that steps in and has a cat's balls cut off. It's upsetting to me. I don't know why. It is. But I got to do it, because if he gets out, he could make more kittens. Maybe it'll calm him down. But it has to be done, and I have to stop fucking personalizing it. It's an okay thing to cut your cat's balls off. But he's just coming into himself. See, I'm negotiating. I want to thank all the people that came out to University of California in Santa Barbara, Campbell Hall. That was a great gig. Had the wonderful Kevin Christie open up, and it was an amazing venue. You could hear everything. The acoustics were perfect. And I did a little Q&A with some students afterwards, and that was enriching and fulfilling. And I felt like I was helping the young people of our country. Also, thanks to everybody who came out to Largo last night and watched that two-hour marathon of a show. I don't want to call it a marathon because it was a good show, and it made me feel a little more prepared, because I got Carnegie coming up, and I've made it a big deal in my mind. I guess it is a big deal because it is that venue. But before I took the job on GLOW, I had to move a lot of dates, but I thought I was going to be doing a lot of dates, and these dates are working out. When you hear this, I will have done the Ice House last night, and hopefully that went well. I don't know yet because it's still a couple hours away. I'm doing a little time travel shifting, but I always want to be show my gratitude for those who come out to see me. Oh my God. I'm getting old. I turned 53 a few weeks ago, and I'm starting to see it in pictures of me more. I'm starting to think, what happens now? What do I do? I'm starting to think maybe a small house somewhere in New Mexico. What does it all mean? Is it all happening? Is all the meaning already there? Do I already know? Is it within me? Am I missing it? What's happening? I know this. I talked to Sarah Jessica Parker for a little while. She's on a new HBO show. It's called Divorce. It's on right now. New episodes premiere Sundays at 9:30 p.m. And you can watch it anytime on HBO Go, HBO Now, and HBO On Demand. I need to mention this before we get into this interview, because I am a moron with names. I've known people decades, and I do not know or remember their name. I think that's a skill one has to learn, or else it's just because I'm so self-involved. But Sarah Jessica brings up Paul Sims, who, of course, I know and I've had conversations with. But when she brings up his name, I'm like, I don't think I know him, because I'm a fucking moron and I'm self-involved, I guess. But I want to set that straight, because I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. So this is me and Sarah Jessica Parker in a hotel room talking. Enjoy. I swear to God, I get insecure. Like, I was like, oh, it's
I was going to bring water from the car
because
I didn't want to make you pay for water.
No, I don't care about paying for water. I just don't. I get the same feeling for some reason. There's certain people, like, they come over to my garage. I'm like, oh, it's a mess. Yeah, she's going to, what is she going to think of me?
And, I should talk about what we should. I wish I were in your garage. I mean, I'm happy to be home in New York, but I really do. So if this goes well and you feel that I've deserving of, for some reason, we've not covered enough. And
part two. Sarah Jessica Parker.
Then,
you know what? And honestly, though, if you're in LA and you want to see the garage,
I can just come by. Yeah, we don't have to, you don't have to speak to me.
You can come in. I don't usually do full length interviews more than once.
Okay. You need. I'm not asking for you to do a part two, really. What I'm basically saying is that I just want to see the garage.
You come over, and then you know what we could do? We could do like a short interview, which I do a lot of you, having that experience.
Okay.
It'd just be Sarah Jessica Parker experiences the garage.
All right, that's fine. And I'll notice things. I'll see details.
Sure,
and have you ever interviewed Amy Sedaris?
I have interviewed Amy Sedaris
in
live.
In the garage? Oh, no. God, she would love your garage.
But she's like a unicorn. You can't, like getting her to do things. Like the one time I interviewed her, she was in a panic because she had to go somewhere. And it was all a very rushed situation.
Really?
Yeah, but it was hilarious.
Yeah, she's really...
There's
she's
nobody
kind of,
more consistently delivers whatever it is she delivers.
She's really, describing her as a unicorn is kind of great. I mean, she is sort of, she's one of the truly magical people I've ever known in my life.
Right. And every part of her, whatever she's doing that morning, you're like, what?
I know.
What you did,
but
what?
I think also it's because she commits such an enormous amount of, everything is given equal value.
Right.
You know, whether it's like, going to the market to look for some peculiar, maybe kind of contraband vegetable or finding proper rickrack for an apron she's making.
She's all in.
I mean, it's a real lesson in kind of an enthusiasm.
Yeah. And she's like sort of, it's sort of like she's like a poet in a way.
Yeah. She's like really.
Everything's loaded up. Like everything has the same sort of electricity.
But I would imagine she would love your garage. Like she loves.
We probably don't get no talking done. She'd be taking things off the
shelf.
Yeah. Like, what's this?
Yeah. Examining, looking underneath.
I'd like her to do it. But like I say, she's one of those people where it's like, really? She's going to come? Yeah. I'd be amazed.
Yeah.
If I could get her there.
We can work on that.
I come back here and I don't recognize the city. So if you have memories from that long ago.
I have memories prior because prior to my official arrival in our Volkswagen bus with everything we owned, my real father was from New York. So we came to New York to visit my father and my grandparents, my paternal grandparents, not infrequently. So I have been coming to visit New York
since you were a kid.
Since the early 70s, and specifically Brooklyn, which was as unique then as Manhattan was.
Totally.
Meaning the changes are as obvious to the eye.
Right. That's sort of my memory too. Like my grandmother was in Jersey and I would fly back and I'd take the bus in. When I was 14, she would put me on a bus.
The
in
red and
Jersey.
Tan lines?
I don't remember which ones, but who would do that now? 14 years old. Go ahead. Go into Times Square.
You know what?
Have a good time.
I think you know what's so funny? We were talking about this last night because I was a young working actor from the time I was very, very young prior to my arrival in New York. And
In Ohio.
Yeah, I started acting when I was 8.
All right, so now we can go back to that. So you were born in Ohio. Your parents were together. Your father
Correct.
Was a professor. I'm not saying this like I'm reading it. We talked about
we
it
We already talked about this.
On.
We're reviewing.
Yeah, he was a poet. He started the American Poetry Review.
The American
Review,
Poetry Review.
And then he got out of poetry.
And then he got out of poetry. And we moved to Cincinnati. And we lived in Cincinnati, Ohio until I was 11. So from 5 to 11, I lived in Cincinnati.
But no dad.
My mother remarried in 1968.
68?
Yeah, in 68.
So you're 3.
So I'm 3. And they are
How
still
that
married.
Guy?
He's wonderful. I mean, I have two great fathers.
So you're in Cincinnati.
So
doing
I,
a big training.
So I'm in
with
Cincinnati.
The local method acting.
No, instructed. You know what it was? Seriously? It was because my parents read the paper. And in the paper.
This is your mom and your stepdad.
My mom and my stepdad.
And what's your stepdad do?
He's a truck driver.
He was a truck driver
Continues to be. He's a Teamster.
A Teamster, so local, not like cross country.
He's a local. He was at that time. He was a semi driver. He was an 18-wheeler grain. He was driving grain across the country back and forth.
So that's good. So you had a truck to climb into for fun.
Yes, and he would pick a child, and we could accompany him on a shorter trip, and we would sleep in the cab.
Right.
Above. Yeah.
Yeah. It was like a bunk bed kind of situation.
Yeah. Exactly.
That's a great thing to have as a child.
I mean, both my fathers are very interesting. And, well, at least I think so. And anyway,
siblings are there?
I'm one of eight.
What?
Yeah.
How's that pan out? Wait, the original set. How many do you have?
So I'm the youngest of my biological parents.
Okay, that's how
my
you
mother
call
it. Remarried,
right.
And had four more. So my mother's had eight children,
really?
With two husbands.
And
so I'm the fourth of eight.
And what do you know them all?
I'm fairly familiar with most of them. Yeah. No, yeah, I do. Pip and Toby, Rachel, Sarah, Jessica, Andrew, Megan, Allegra, and Aaron.
That's crazy. And did a couple of them are in show business?
Yeah. So my brother Pippin is the dean of the new school writing, directing, and acting program.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a pretty important position.
Yeah, I'm very proud of him. My brother Toby is a great and beautiful actor and singer, and he's been on Broadway a lot and is very special, very gifted. My sister Rachel was in the medical profession, and then she married and had a family and couldn't devote what the medical profession requires.
Right.
And now she's sort of getting back into it. And then my brother Andrew is the house prop man for the Roundabouts Broadway house.
Right. Oh, here, the Roundabout Theater?
Uh-huh.
Oh, my God.
And my sister Megan.
Like the Barrymores.
Without all the sort of prestige and drunken, we used to think we were the Glass family, like we used to imagine this is, you know, the ideal version, but we're in fact not, it turned out. My sister Megan pulls focus. She's a focus puller
for movies.
My sister Allegra is like a masseuse.
Job.
She's a masseuse.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Groovy.
She's a masseuse.
Yeah.
And my little baby brother, Aaron, who is no longer a baby, who's expecting his first baby, he's a Teamster also.
He's a truck guy?
He is. He typically drives one of the vans.
Here in New York?
In the movie business.
Uh-huh.
And my father's in the movie business now, too.
In Cincinnati?
My stepfather is a Teamster in the movie business in New York City.
He is.
Yes.
He's here now.
He's here.
No one's in Ohio.
Our whole family moved here.
Everybody's here.
The whole family moved here on January 1st of 1977. Everything we owned in our VW
Eight
bus.
Kids.
There
Not
were
yet.
Six at the six. Time.
In the
My
bus.
Mother was pregnant. My mother was pregnant with Allegra,
Crazy.
So she couldn't travel with us.
So you just, as a Teamster, he could get, like, you could just get work.
Yes.
Like, they could take care of
That was
here.
His hope. That was
right.
his hope.
Okay.
And we were one of the first families to move to Roosevelt Island, but when we arrived, because we were part of the subsidized housing, when we arrived, it wasn't complete, so we had no place to stay.
So you're just out there on that island with that train car?
So we had to find a hotel room, and the only hotels that we could afford were not in the city. We ended up at the Holiday Inn in Yonkers.
Six kids. A pregnant mom, maybe.
One father.
Yeah.
And a mother back in Cincinnati.
Oh, she wasn't
closing up
out
the house. Yet. She couldn't travel with us.
And the real dad was here?
And my real father at that point lived in Philadelphia.
So he was no help.
Well, I mean, it's not that he didn't offer to help, but it would have been peculiar
hour
for him
and a half
to,
away. Right.
You know,
did they
can
know
help
each
with
other?
The kids? Yes, they too are familiar with each other.
But at that time, was it contentious or was it all right?
I would say that, like a lot
sure,
of divorces,
of course.
It was complicated. Let's put it that way.
Well,
but
yeah,
I think it was civilized but complicated.
Right. I watched
divorce.
The first episode, the pilot of Divorce, of the new show for HBO. It was kind of gnarly, man.
Yeah, it's gnarly.
It's like you go from the glamorous New York City defining socialite to like this suburban nightmare.
Mm.
But it was funny. You guys, I mean, it was dark and it was disturbing, but you guys are so good. What's his name? Thomas Hayden Church?
Thomas Hayden Church.
Oh,
isn't
my
he just
God.
Great?
He's
so good.
And Molly Shannon for a few minutes. Does she come back?
Tracy
I didn't
Letts.
Watch him.
Talia Balsam.
Do they come back? Tracy
they
Letts
all
is the
come
one who
back.
Had the heart attack.
Yeah. They all come back quite a bit. Yeah,
Tracy Letts.
They're all regulars. Yeah, it's
really.
Great. Yeah, I describe it as
the guy from the Flight of the Conchords. Is he out? Is
Jermaine?
Is he back? Does he come back, or is that it?
I'll say that there will be a drive by. Right. I don't want to say too much.
Right,
you know?
No, I get it. I get it.
I don't want to titillate your audience.
Yeah,
you know?
Well, I mean, I'll tell you one thing. The twist at the end, and it is a twist.
Yeah.
Was sort of like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's going to be interesting because I didn't watch them all because then I probably would have spoiled something. But watching the pilot was that, you know, to keep those characters sympathetic, to keep your character sympathetic,
yeah.
you know, given what we know
yeah.
and given it is going to be tricky. But it is because it's already sympathetic because
it's real.
What happens.
It's real. Yeah.
It's like that's what happens. Like
yeah,
that
exactly.
scene, the scene on the train with you and, you know, yeah. and that riff she lays on you.
Yeah.
About like you think you're in love.
Yeah. And, yeah. It's sort yeah.
of, it's sad, but human beings really have this very small menu of how they fuck things up.
Yeah. Yeah. And especially smart people.
Yeah.
Who surprise themselves making bad choices, behaving badly, terrible counsel.
Right.
Which is typically their own.
Right.
You know?
Well, it's a rationalization thing.
Yeah. And I think what I love about playing that part and what I love about her
mm-hmm.
is that people used to be like, oh, you know, do you like Carrie Bradshaw? I was like, yeah. I mean, I love playing Carrie Bradshaw. And I love playing that part.
Just for the clothes, right?
Just actually for the story. Uh-huh. I loved telling that story. And they would say, you know, is she likable? I was like, yeah, I mean, she's a human being. But what I think is so interesting about Frances is that she is not buoyant like Carrie. She is not, she's prickly and she's chilly, but I feel like she's incredibly real and that she is like an enormous number of people who have made a commitment and gone back to the well and dug deep and are weary and exhausted in a marriage and feel that there's this sort of deadening inertia. And that one line she says, I want to save my life while I still have a chance, I think is very real. And I think she's...
I feel it now. And I'm not married and I'm not a
yeah.
woman. And I'm like,
yeah.
And I'm just at this point in my life where you have a moment. You're not that much younger than me. And I'm not saying that in a mean way.
No.
Where you're like, what's the fucking point?
Yeah.
You know, what happens now? How much time do I have left?
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, and why should it suck?
Yeah. And so what do you do to salvage what you imagine are your remaining years? And what I think often you discover
yeah.
is that it's not, for the most part, it's really with the complication of children and financial issues that are real and are a true strain in this particular relationship that we're talking about on the show. It's not what you imagine. It's not. I mean, the liberation sort of hangs in front of you like this great shiny lure. But the truth of divorce or an attempt at divorce is just for middle class people, it is painful. If you don't have money to throw at it and get out of it clean, it is a very painful, complicated,
yeah.
disappointing failure.
I don't even have kids, and my second divorce was horrendous.
Yeah, it's really so. Anyway, so I love playing her, and it's and Thomas was my first choice, and I cannot believe he said yes.
He's so thrilled. He's a very unique performer,
isn't he?
And you know, and his ability to be funny is just like sort of he's one of those people that you yeah. just kind of wait. You know, something funny is going to happen.
Yeah.
And it's completely horrifying.
Yeah.
Wait, I want to talk about this relationship stuff, though. Because what you're saying is that even when you make the choices that would, in your mind at that moment, imply that, you know, this is going to make it better, you know, there's other things to be reckoned with. Like
yeah.
the loneliness, the, you know, maintaining a relationship with your children that's not detrimental to them.
Yeah.
You know,
and,
like
and sort of
to,
what have you done to the, you know, I think the first things that have become apparent is, first of all, just on a practical level, you're missing an extra set of hands, right?
Right.
So you're a working person and you need to work.
Right.
You're in a job that is not satisfying in any way.
Yeah.
You're in debt. You're, you know, changing credit cards for the best, you know, interest rates constantly. You're
right.
trying to be a good parent to make up for what are very transparent, you know, felonies, basically,
right.
to your children, in your children's eyes.
Right.
You've committed horrible.
Yeah.
yeah. And how do you, I don't know, how do you begin? How do you
right.
sort of surface?
Yeah. My brother went through it. Yeah. And everyone knows people who went through it. Did you have people that you were sort of like, you've kind of, walk through this horrible thing?
Well, I started working on this show like 4 years ago.
Yeah.
And I was initially just interested in marriages and affairs because I was at the point where I had a lot of friends who were either contemplating divorce, survived divorce, didn't survive divorce in their own way, came out of divorce thinking it was the best thing that ever happened.
Both sides.
All of it. And, you know, friends that were having affairs that didn't affect the marriage, having affairs that did, having affairs that were, you know,
well, I mean, you're married,
all that sort of stuff, right? And I'm married for a long time.
And God knows you've run things through your head.
Well, I think all of us sort of think about all of it,
sure.
You know,
all of us
and
do.
I think it's really interesting. And there were great shows about marriage, you know, but I wanted to sort of, I wanted to look at it this way and in a truthful way, but that you can find the humor in all this because the environment allows for absurdity and ridiculousness and silly, you know, I mean, there's things about it that you can, so it's not just this sort of,
oh no, it can be so doomy. Well, yeah, but just the, like that feeling of like when you show up at the door, that's, I'm not going to tip anymore. Like that, when your heart falls through you and you realize like.
Yeah. And he's in every position, you know, he says some brutal stuff, but,
right
but
there.
He's, it's his, you know, this,
it's his feelings,
it's his feelings
sure.
and I'm deserving of, you know, I should be the recipient of those, but it's really, it's deadening, you know, but I love it. And I love what we get to do. And I'm thrilled that we got
producer?
To.
Are
you executive producer? Mm-hmm.
And was it your idea to champion this? I mean, did you pull it to the HBO?
So it's an idea I had that we were developing.
Oh, it's all you?
Yeah. And then, so I was, but I was focused more on the affair. So then eventually I have a little company at HBO and we produce.
Right.
And eventually we started meeting writers, one of whom was Sharon, and we hired Sharon and she wrote our pilot. And then we brought on Paul Sims, who's our showrunner. Do you know Paul?
I don't. You know
I
who
can't
I know?
Believe you don't
Tom
know Paul.
Tom Sharpling.
Oh my God.
He was just here.
I love Tom Sharpling.
Sharpling's the best.
Do you know what I love to do to Tom Sharpling?
Oh no.
You love to hug him.
Oh yeah.
God, so I love to hug him.
He's like, ooh.
It's just... He is somebody, I sent him an email because Tom Sharpling is very special to me, and he won't hear it.
Yeah.
But.
He was sitting right there yesterday. We do.
No freaking way.
We do these shows sometimes, the Mark and Tom show.
Didn't know that. How can I not
done,
know this?
Well, there's only been two.
Oh, okay.
And then we haven't done one in a couple of years because, you know, we're both broadcasters and we both have a mutual respect for each other. And he cracks me up. So, like, when we have time, we'll just talk.
Oh, how great.
On the mic. So we did one yesterday.
Oh, and he's
great. He's so funny and so...
So fond of him.
Unique.
And I love, like, you know, toward the end, he was so valuable on the set for me.
Yeah.
In particular.
Yeah.
Like, he would just know when to... come by and after a take or after a really complicated, hard scene, whether it was hard because of the choreography or the emotion that was required or pain, whatever it was,
right.
He would come by and he would just tap me on the back
or
just say something sort of sentimental and romantic,
right.
You know? And it meant the world to me.
Yeah, he's a sweetheart.
Because he was really paying attention, and it was really important to me that he come back for the second season, which he did. So,
good.
Yeah, I'm. How did we start talking about him? How'd that happen?
So
we hired
Paul
Sharon.
Simmons. I'm not
we
sure
hired
I know
Paul.
If I know him or not.
And Paul.
Who's Sharon?
Sharon Horgan is a writer and an actor, and she has a show on called Catastrophe.
Oh, that's what I was mistaking it.
Right.
Like, with Rob Delaney.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but this is a separate.
Right.
And so she.
Your initial idea was the affair.
The affair in a marriage. I wanted to have it be...
And that's all you had. That's all you
had. I had a lot of very specific ideas.
Mm-hmm.
But what I was excited about when I met Sharon was she was really interested in divorce. And she was interested in some of the bigger themes that I found really compelling.
Yeah.
And a larger part of this whole thing was 70s cinema. And, you know... An unmarried woman has always played a huge role in my life. Like
that's,
huge.
And
just the way we used to shoot movies in the 70s and the music. So all the music, I don't know if you've noticed, is from the 70s.
Yeah, I did. Now that you mentioned
it.
And that one scene where he's outside watching the events in that suburban fancy house.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was very 70s.
Isn't it great?
Yeah. That was good. And he's just standing there like a doofus.
It's really sad.
Like, yeah, it's brutal.
But it's beautifully shot, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, no,
so
it looks great.
I figured the reason I wanted that 70s music is I was like, oh, this is the music. This would be the music that informed their growing up lives, right?
Right, sure.
This was the music they fell in love to.
Right.
Not even with each other, but they fell in love the first time and the second time and the third time and the 11th time. And this is now the music that they are... falling up part two, you know, too. Yeah. So
the music you smoke your first cigarettes to.
Yeah, it's really good. It's all too. It's all so evocative. Yeah. And it's just what could we afford? Mm-hmm. So anyway.
Oh,
yeah.
Right. That's good. That was smart. These songs can't be that much.
Oh my God.
It's crazy.
No, it's really crazy. And we're a tight show. I mean, we don't have like a crazy, we're not profligate with the money. We're really like, we're lean.
Are you?
Yeah, we're lean.
Is that your choice?
Yeah, because the
I always
the
feel like
more,
HBO just sort of like, how much do you need?
No, I mean, not with us. But I prefer that because I feel like...
Maybe you wore armor and stuff and there was some
Yeah, and
fantasy.
So was some... Yeah, or maybe if we were an hour. I don't know. But the thing about that kind of discipline mm-hmm. and limitations is you're really thoughtful about every choice. And then if you really want something, you can argue for it. But if you're constantly asking for rain machines for no reason,
right.
then yeah, it's like staying out too late with really good, you know, it's like just because you can say the F word on HBO doesn't mean you have to or you should. You should be like mindful. And then when you say it, it's got like, it really, it's got basement, you know?
Well, I'm in. After a pilot, I'm in.
Oh, good. I hope there are at least 12 others who say the same thing. Or
it's going to be
1,200
good.
Others.
Well, people, I think what's going to be interesting is to see, it is a really wild, dramatic shift for your cultural character. Like, you know, you sort of like reinvented New York City with that show. And you represent this thing. Like you get, I imagine you can't even walk down the street that easily. Can you?
No, I mean, I'm physically I'm capable.
Right, but you just
but there are people that like to stop and chat. Let's put it that way.
It's always sort of like, I'm sorry, I don't want to be rude. Yeah. But I got some things I need to say to you.
You know, they like to share intimate details. But yesterday I was running to a charity dinner, and I was like really running, and all these young girls, and I was like, I can't right now. I'm
because you feel bad, right?
I feel terrible.
And now it's not even autographs, terrible. It's just pictures.
No, it's just phones.
Sort of yeah.
So listen, so you know, okay, because you know Louis C.K. so well. So
you must live close to him, no?
I think we do.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he and my husband have...
Matthew Broderick.
Have been friends for a while, and we were talking about this, you know, the phone call, the phones, the cameras,
and Louis
the phones.
Oh, Louis got no policies, and, no policies.
Right,
no phone
so but
policies.
What he did... But now we hear he doesn't anymore, and you can confirm this, but this is, okay, so this is what Matthew told me that Louis said, mm-hmm. is when people came up to him with and said, may I, he would say, they won't.
Yeah.
They won't. They won't.
Huh.
And it was so disarming and so bizarre that people were left stunned, and then I guess he could move on freely, right?
So they go, can I take your picture? And he goes,
and he's like, I'm sorry, they won't.
Yeah.
So I was like, well, this is...
Tricky.
This is like brilliant. This is like... So complex. So I decided last year to start trying They Won't, which amused me to no end. And it was really interesting experience to see people sort of stop and be
because it's
kind
not
of like,
no.
It's not no.
And usually it's an answer to the question that they just asked their friend. Do you think they would?
Right. I'm sorry, they won't. So we tried this. This was funny. It worked in a, you know... We just made it work. I made it work. But then I was traveling, and we went last year, my husband, myself, and my kids, we went to Sweden. We landed in Stockholm. This was for a family holiday.
Yeah.
You know, it's evening there, and it's June, and the night sky is you know, it's bright until like 11, but it's exquisite. And the city, you know, the skyline of Stockholm. And I say to the kids, and we got a babysitter, and I say, but, you know, Papa and I are going to take a walk. We're going to cross the bridge in Stockholm, and you guys can hang out here. And Matthew and I are... walking across this bridge, and we're like, oh, the Swedish people, look how they're so classy. There's no one, cameras and phones, and we're having this really pleasant, we just feel like we've been completely freed.
Right.
And we're walking down small, narrow streets in the old town, and I just see something out of the corner of my eye, and I know movement now.
Right, yeah.
And this woman leaps up from her chair, and she comes running after me, and she's like, oh my God, Sarah! Oh my God, Sarah and Jessica! Oh my God, I'm here, can I take a photo? And she's got a thing, I go, they won't. And she goes, who's they? She's the first person ever. Who's they?
Of course.
Literally, I was like, weird. Tears were, I was, laughing. My husband and I ran like small children. We ran away from her, but I could not believe she said, who's this?
Right. Classic New York Jewish logic. What are you talking about?
I was
dying. What do you think, I'm a moron?
Finally, someone said, who's they?
And it had to be in that
but
accent.
Then I heard that,
with
he,
that
Louis doesn't do it anymore. I heard he's now just no.
No. Yeah, no, that's that was my idea.
So how does he do it and not feel lousy for the next 20, 45 seconds?
I don't
know.
Yeah, I don't know. You'd have to ask him. But I think that ultimately what you start to realize also with you, I'm sure you know, that if there's a street situation – that if you let one person, all of a sudden there's 10 people.
Yeah.
And I think that what happens over time is that people know that they're being, you know, intrusive, and it's a gamble.
Right, right.
You know,
they're asking you while the camera's shooting. This is the other
part
that's
or else
odd.
They sneak one, and then they become sort of dicks, you know. But I can't imagine, like, I don't know what kind of fans you have, you know, but, you know, but I imagine they're pretty respectful, and they expect a lot out of you. But Louis can get any number of different types of people. There could be guys like, yo, Louis!
Right.
But you get that, too, I bet.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of, you know, I get kind of all of it. I live in New York, so I'm on the streets all the time. I mean, the thing I try to say, which is foolish, because by the time I've, like, you know, trot out this kind of mini monologue, I could have taken the picture.
Right.
But I try to say to them, isn't this more meaningful? Just this exchange of me saying I can't, that I'm with my kids.
You've tried to say that?
I say it all the time. I'm like, pretend we're in a time machine and it's 1940 and you don't happen to have a camera with you. Or when people are like, oh my God, I can't believe I don't have my camera. I go, I'm so glad you don't have your camera. Because now what we're doing is we're going to have a quick conversation about, I'm sorry I can't, but I owe you. I'm always like, I owe you. Next time you see me, it's going to be a better moment. I owe you.
Oh yeah. Until you get the one guy who's like, you've said that five times, Sarah.
But I feel like I wish people would just, because they're not even looking at you when they're asking you for this picture. They're not.
Yeah, they're getting their phone ready.
Yeah. I was like, but wouldn't you rather just for 2 seconds just tell me your name? Where are you from?
And it's weird because the photos
they get.
Why
are you here today?
Yeah. Like I've done meet and greets and like I'm exhausted after a stand-up show. And then I see people on Facebook, you know, posting these pictures of me with one eye open, like my mouth hanging open. There's like dozens of pictures of me
But there's
exhausted.
There wasn't actually an exchange that they can call upon the other than the shaking hand of trying to get their phone to work and it never works when they want it to work at that moment, which is heartbreaking.
They have that
by
story.
The way,
it is like relax.
Yeah, no, I always feel like it's okay, and I can't help them because I don't have an iPhone, so I don't know how to use an iPhone. I can't.
You don't have an iPhone?
No, I have a BlackBerry.
Why?
I've had one since 1999.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
So you're not distracted constantly.
I'm a very
monogamous with the phone.
Yeah.
That's good. So you have what? 3 kids?
I have 3 kids, yeah.
How old are they?
My son is, he'll be 14 in October.
Yeah.
And my daughters are new 7-year-olds. They're twins.
Wow.
Yeah.
So is that, are you enjoying that?
Every single day?
No, of course not. Yeah.
No, yes, I know I do. I love it.
And
I
you
love
and
it.
Broderick get along good?
Yeah, I get along. I like him still. I really like him.
He's an interesting guy.
Yeah, he is. He's like a kind of like a secret weapon. Like he's like a quiet. Yeah.
He's very funny too.
He's very funny. He's bright.
Mm-hmm.
He's interesting.
That's good.
Yeah, he's great.
That's good.
Yeah.
That you survived the whole thing.
Yeah, I think it's, let me see, wait. 92 to 2002, 2002 to 2012, 2012 to 24 years.
24 years? Yeah. You've been with him?
And we've been married. It'll be, 24. We'll be married 19 years in March.
That's impressive.
I don't know.
Congratulations.
I feel bad for him sometimes.
You do?
Yeah. Like when, because we loved Amy Sedaris for so long. And Amy and I met in 2000. We met on, we were supposed to start rehearsals on September 11th.
For
a play.
You and Amy.
Yes, in 2001.
Yeah.
And we were crazy, crazy fans of Amy's.
Yeah.
And when my husband finally met Amy, I felt like, shoot.
They should be together?
They should be together. And she always used to say, I'm going to drive a wedge between your marriage. I'm going to drive a wedge between your marriage. And I was like, I don't think you have to work that hard. Like, I think if he were allowed, like, they should be together.
Should they?
Well, I feel sometimes I see him and I'm like, well, you know, that person should probably have an opportunity to spend some time with you. But I'm not really willing to do that.
I always picture Amy to be above all these sort of mortal struggles, like marriages and stuff.
Well, that's part of the unicorn.
Well, yeah, because
yeah.
like I mean, they should be together, but how much can Matthew handle? Like, look at the rabbit.
I don't know. I think that's a good question, but we'll not know. We'll never know. We'll never know.
The rabbit's on
right?
your head.
But she does other things besides want to look at rabbits.
Sure, look at the cake I
She's
baked.
A great, great reader.
I know.
She's a great thinker. I know. You're not. I know. I don't know. Yeah, so yeah, long time we've been together.
All right, well.
Long time.
Well, I'm sorry that, Amy, maybe there's still time for that. I don't know.
Who knows?
Maybe.
Who knows?
But let's get back to the VW van.
Okay.
So you get here, it's not good. You're staying in Yonkers. You're at a hotel with your six siblings
yep.
and your truck driving dad. Your
yep.
mom's in Cincinnati.
Mm-hmm.
Your real dad's in Philadelphia, not being a poet.
Correct. He's
a
being a businessman, correct?
But was there a real distinct sort of like, I'm done with poetry, fuck letters, I'm out?
I mean, I should probably let him
we have no time
tell his story, but
we don't do fun
I
things.
Think what, honestly, I think what happened is that he, after he stopped writing poetry, and I'm uncertain as to why he stopped, he became a journalist. And
oh, okay.
He was a successful journalist. And I think what he really was interested in was business. And he started small businesses in Philadelphia when Philadelphia was sort of reinventing itself and
like
redoing
Philly.
Its downtown, you know, the
yeah.
new market.
You he like was, it?
Yeah, I like Philly very much.
That Reed Market or Reading Market?
He was part
market?
Of
Reading
this
market.
Thing called the New Market.
Oh, okay. Well,
and
I just like Philly.
And I think it's a great,
yeah.
beautiful city. I mean,
it's rough.
Complicated and
yeah.
rough, but it's an
yeah.
exquisite city. Yeah. So anyway, he started the first Dan and Frozen yogurt store and a bath store.
Well,
like he helped kind of revitalize.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then he went into penny stocks.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went into he
Is
was
that
one of
name
the
for
early
junk bonds or junk stocks.
I think penny stocks are like low
yeah.
value,
right, sure.
you
yeah.
know.
Yeah,
but
like
I think
Wolf of
in
Wall
bulk
Street
maybe.
Yeah.
I'm not entirely sure
I'm not
I understand
saying it's bad. Right.
what happens
right.
in,
he
the,
got into
in
the market
the trade
at that
of
time.
Penny stocks. Then he had a thought that he should buy and bundle big time from the telephone companies and sell them to local people. He was one of those early kind of Sprint guys.
Ah.
So he had a company called U.S. Watts.
Okay.
That
it was a phone company.
That was a phone company that would buy in bulk
mm-hmm.
and then redistribute
right.
at lesser prices, like all of those companies that flourished.
So
and
he's like a Robin Hood.
Sort of a
Robin Hood
Renaissance
of the
man.
Well, he's like, I'm taking the expensive phone and you can get it for cheaper.
Yeah, except I'm not certain it was meant to be...
A good thing.
A good thing.
Right.
I mean, I think he was looking... And then he retired. And now he's retired.
And he was in Brooklyn?
He lives in Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay.
He lives outside.
Did he remarry and everything?
Remarried in 1984.
Okay.
A fantastic woman. Yeah.
So you're out there on Roosevelt Island that's incomplete.
So then we finally get to Roosevelt Island.
Yeah.
And we live there unhappily.
How can you be happy out there? I don't want to knock anybody. I'll get emails now. Like, we're very happy on Roosevelt Island, not being in touch with anybody. I went out there once on a one-night bad decision. And I was like, where the fuck am I? What did I do?
Well, I think a lot of people live there very happily now.
It's not
we
Staten
were
Island.
The first,
it is right there.
We were the first families. And I
right,
think it had
the
not...
Pioneers.
Had not worked out.
It was a social idea. It was an idea, community
yes,
idea.
Yes, and for families who couldn't afford to live.
Is that really what it was
for
initially?
For us it was, because
it
had
that?
Subsidized. It still has subsidized.
Oh, that's
the
good.
Island is still broken up into subsidized, as far as I know, middle,
right,
upper middle,
so
and then there's like, you know, high-end,
nice
fancy
well,
housing.
That's interesting. So it's
and
a really
now
a
it's
grand
like a
social experiment.
Yeah, I think so. And the reason my parents knew about it was they had read about it in New York Magazine. They did a big cover story on this island that was being built. And we applied to the management company that was operated out of the city. It was like a municipal organization. It was Urban Dwellers Management.
Oh, okay, okay.
And so we applied through that program.
Yeah.
And then we moved there. And my mom, who's not a snob, had never... Even though we were poor, she'd never not had her own washer and dryer. And she'd never lived like this. And I will say, these places were not built well.
Yeah.
You know, we moved in and the sink was crooked and the walls were made of tissue paper. And
yeah.
It was an experiment I think we were not equipped for.
But why New York, though?
I think my dad wanted to work here and we were young actors.
So that's like we didn't get to that. So that started in Cincinnati, the
mm-hmm,
acting,
mm-hmm.
And all of you were doing it. I mean,
not
like,
all of us. My brother Toby,
yeah,
and and I, both of us were actors at the time. And I think my parents thought that my dad could be a truck driver here, and later he started a business that transported Broadway shows on the road, so he would do the buses and the trucks.
That's
for those
big
bus and truck companies. And I'm not certain why they made this sacrifice.
What'd your mom do?
My mother was a school teacher for years until I was about two or three, and then she couldn't anymore. I mean, she had a lot of kids. Yeah. And so she taught in Appalachia. She taught in the foothills of Appalachia. So she taught second grade, and her students were anywhere from like 7 to 14 year olds.
And now what is your father is Jewish? Your real
My
father?
My real father's Jewish. Both his parents are Jewish.
I always thought you were kind of Jewish.
I know people do, but I feel like I don't really have a right to claim that. My father is, so I'm half, right?
Right.
And my mother is not. So, I mean,
yeah.
But culturally, I identify in a lot of ways.
Well, there's that weird line of New York Jewish, New York Italian,
right.
New York Irish. So you can fall in, you know what I mean? Because
you're
New
York.
Yeah,
and I think I fall into, I mean, I have some claim, right?
Sure,
I mean,
of course.
My father was not observant.
I'm not going to deny you any claim.
His family wasn't as observant. His parents weren't. But
Jewish.
We were raised with no religious education of any kind.
Do you have any religion now?
No.
What's Matt? He's half Jewish too, right?
Matthew's mother was Jewish and his father was Irish Catholic.
How was he brought up?
Not observant, but his mother's worldview, I think he would agree with, was very much from the point of view of a Jew.
Uh-huh.
Like always looked at the world with that lens.
Right.
I think
which is not
uncommon also for her generation. She's passed, but
sure.
Which is, I think, I see this as a Jew. So
she
how
came
am
to New
I
York
responding?
As an immigrant
she
family?
Was, no, she was born here, and there's like third generation.
But New York Jews.
New York Jew. True New York Jew.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, it's sort of wild, though, that you both have this very, like, Irish Catholic and Jewish is not that unusual. And
right.
And then, like, just like his mother, he's actually has some, he's theoretically Jewish.
Yes.
His mother was Jewish.
He always says, if.
If they came,
Hitler.
For,
yeah, that's
right.
If
yeah,
they
yeah.
came, I would be.
I'd
taken.
Be on the list.
Yeah, and I would maybe straddle.
You might be able to get
I
away.
Might
but now with the internet,
be in some
they
sort
can
of
get anybody.
Purgatory,
right?
Of,
right.
Like,
yeah.
a waiting period.
Sure. Yeah. You get leniency.
But my mother, when I was younger, she always said that she was an atheist because my parents were very political, and so she, I think, her thoughts were how could there be a God if there was, you know, there's so much conflict in the
right.
world and there's so much
sure.
pain
yeah.
and loss
yeah.
and inequality. So how can there be a good God that is allowing? So her thing was like, I'm an atheist. I don't believe in God.
Working class progressives.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And my stepfather is a Green Party member.
Really?
And he is a Christian. A uh-huh. true old-fashioned Christian. Do you know what I mean by that?
Yeah.
I mean, like,
it's in him.
He is not a
moralist, but like
not at all.
Right.
He's extremely
poor,
principled.
You know,
his parish is the most diverse building
right.
I've sat in with.
But it's about Christian principles.
Christian principles of volunteerism,
sure, right.
community,
charity,
giving
service.
To other service. Yeah, completely. It's really
that's a very
beautiful.
Noble thing. It is.
It's really
people who really abide by that, and they make it their life, and they find joy in that.
Tolerant and accepting, and are wanting to hear people who are different than themselves.
Yeah.
Ideology that is counter and even anathema. They are this is the type
acceptance.
of community that he
worships
at religiously, literally every single Sunday.
Really?
Even if it gets in the way of a family event. Yeah.
That's something. That's beautiful.
Yeah, it's we've gone a couple times. My daughters love it.
Why wouldn't they?
We have a really wonderful Unitarian church in New York called All Souls.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I get there, they send a morning.
Every day you get their little wake-up call?
It's, I should read, I mean.
Do something nice today?
No, it's they pull from, you know, scholars and people of, faith. And
I haven't had one of those.
I get it every morning.
It's
a daily meditation. But it's not about
Do you actively
God.
Meditate?
No, I wouldn't have the patience. I tried.
Do you yoga?
No.
What do you do? Nothing?
I run around New York. I live in a town. I run up and down stairs all day long. And we came back, and my daughter's last night. I came home, and I ran up the stairs to the room, and my daughter, Loretta, who's unbelievably honest. She was like, Mama, why are you so out of breath? I was like, well, first of all, because I'm like 150 years old. And second of all, because I'm 150 years old, I just ran up the stairs 9 times to get you what you need.
Yeah.
I'm out of breath. 7-year-old.
So anyway. You've been in show business for like a long time.
Yes.
And
40 years.
Really? It's yeah. So in the... When you came from Cincinnati, what, you had done what? Community theater, children's theater?
No,
what?
I'd done proper... So when I moved here, by the time I moved here, I'd done a play on Broadway, a real, true, beautiful play directed by Harold Pinter called The Innocents.
Do you remember Harold Pinter?
Oh, are you kidding me?
How old were you?
I was 11. I had just been on Broadway. He directed an adaptation of The Turn of the Screw, the Henry James Turn of the Screw, which William Archibald in the 50s did a beautiful adaptation for the stage. And it was me and Claire Bloom who played the governess, and Harold Pinter directed it. And I auditioned in York. I was 10.
Uh-huh.
Went to London to rehearse. Came back. We went out of town like shows used to do, you know, Philadelphia, Boston. Came into New York, played the Morosco Theater. And not only do I remember Harold Pinter, but I was mad for him. I was crazy as a young child, even.
What was the impression?
Well, first of all, he was beautiful. Like, he was beautiful. You know what he looks like, right?
I don't.
Oh, I wish I could pull up a picture. He was extremely handsome, distinguished.
Yeah.
He smelled so great.
Yeah.
He smoked and he drank. Yeah. And he wore a proper men's cologne, but not an intrusive or aggressive. I'd never been around somebody like this in my entire life. I mean, you can imagine.
Like classy British dude?
Yeah, like, you know, at that time, arguably maybe the greatest living playwright on that side of the pond, right?
Yeah.
Because Miller was still alive here in our country. And Pinter, and he was smart and exquisite and a great director. A great director. And at the time, to his death, then with Lady Antonia Fraser. Do you know who Lady Antonia Fraser is? She wrote Mary Queen of Scots.
Yes.
And they had had this wonderfully scandalous relationship. She had been friends. She was married to someone else. He was married to someone else. They'd been friends. And then she left her husband and went off with Harold. And Harold... they stayed together till his last breath.
Oh, that's my
mother,
a good story about divorce.
Loved Lady Antonia Fraser, who wrote great historic books on historical figures.
Yeah.
The most important and you know most talked about of her books was Mary Queen of Scots.
Right.
So they're together, right?
Yeah.
And they're traveling around with their true old Louis Vuitton like steamer trunks.
Yeah.
Then Claire Bloom, who is a magnificent English actress, right? Beautiful, the most beautiful diction and sound of a voice you'll probably ever hear. Her boyfriend at the time was Philip Roth.
Oh, my God.
So my mother always said, jokingly, that she married my father because he reminded her of Philip Roth.
Right.
You know, two Jewish...
Yeah.
If you saw a picture of my dad, you'd be like, wow, that's uncanny.
Intense Jewish men.
Right? Smart writers. Yeah.
Scary.
My
little.
Mother read The New Yorker her whole life, would go to the library as a young girl and ask for The New Yorker. Yeah. So here we are on the road with Harold Pinter, Lady Antonia Fraser, Claire Bloom, and Philip Roth.
They're all there?
Picture my mother. They're all there. We're traveling from city to city. And,
bus? Or are you just
we're
meeting?
We're flying,
right,
but
sure.
We're there every day. And the companions are with them. And anyway, like Harold, we would go to Boston. I was a ballet dancer, and Harold would make sure I got out of rehearsal to go take classes with the Boston Ballet. I mean, he was amazing. He was amazing.
You're like, 10 years old, and you're in the hot core of, like, New York intellectualism and international arts.
I know. It was great. But I only knew that because my parents. Because my parents knew that.
But you felt the impression. I mean,
assuredly.
What was your 10-year-old impression of Philip Roth?
I thought he, too, was really handsome. I knew immediately why my mother said that about him. Like, he was so chic and sexy and... I mean, I knew that. You know, when you're little, you don't not know things.
It's interesting because that time of culture being at the forefront of of, you know, New York intellectual culture and theater culture and international
literature and art.
Literature and art being at the forefront. It's like gone. I mean, the 70s was it.
I know. Everyone thinks we're just nostalgic because we're old, and that's, but like no, but the seven, like, we must reexamine.
Well, yeah,
it's
like,
so...
Harold Pinter and Philip Roth might be on the Dick Cavett show together.
Oh, definitely. On the Dick Cavett show.
Right, and people, now that whole
Yeah, we used to watch all the time. Yeah.
Right, that's so specific.
It was, like, I knew, I wouldn't have known, obviously, if my parents didn't tell me, but you could feel it.
So you do Annie.
Right, so I come to New York.
After Pinter.
After Pinter, I come to New York. This is true. We arrived in New York, and I had an audition, I believe, for Pretty Baby.
Really?
Yes, and...
With Louis Malle?
With Louis Malle. And at the time, there was this great casting director in New York who was in the Gulf and Western building, which is now the freaking Trump, you know, the...
Gulf and Western, right. And that was
Columbus
where
Circle.
Paramount had a...
Correct.
Right,
exactly. And the movie theater was underneath. And so my father was looking for some place for us to stay. So he dropped me off.
Yeah.
And I went up, and my first audition was for Pretty Baby. And I got called back and called back and called back, and eventually read a few times with Louis Malle. So that was my first day in New York. Mm-hmm. Literally, he drove down from the Holiday Inn, dropped me off at the Gulf and Western building, was like, I'll be back. Anyway, didn't get that movie. Auditioned, got some other stuff. And then Annie opened, and I wasn't around for that original audition.
Right.
Because that had happened prior to my arrival.
The show had run for a little while already.
The show opened in April of 77.
Right.
Right? But they started out of town before I came. So at one point, soon after I arrived, there was an audition for the first replacement who was going to leave the show right after it opened.
Right.
So I went, and my parents had taken us to see Annie. They had cobbled together enough money to buy two seats and four standing room. So we would stand, and then two people would switch after intermission.
Yeah.
So two people could sit, and then two people could sit.
Right.
And we watched the show. And have you ever seen Annie? Did
I
you
haven't.
See freaking Annie?
No.
Oh no, it's great.
No, I know.
It's,
I like the song.
Indisputably, no, it's a perfect show.
Okay.
I promise you, it's a perfect show. And I saw it. You know, I was 12 years old, and I was like,
certainly a perfect show for a 12-year-old.
I couldn't believe what I was seeing, and my dad said to me at the time, and I never sang professionally, whatever.
Yeah.
He was like, yeah, he could see in my eyes. He was like, he said to me, you're just not Annie material.
Oh.
You know that. And I was like, I know. But anyway, I got
Why
a call
you say that?
Because I think those girls could belt. They were belters,
right.
And they were big, you know,
bold
performers. And that was not my style.
Right.
But anyway, I got an audition for the show, and I came to this audition, and I sang, the song Nothing from A Chorus Line, which was this great song that this character, Priscilla Lopez's character, sings about being Puerto Rican and wanting to be an actor and going to performing arts and never really achieving what the drama teacher keeps telling her, you're nothing, you should just go to, you know, the Catholic school down the street. And it's got, you know, like a curse word in it. But I love this song. I saw it. I'm sorry, I'm all over the place. But
no,
I
great.
Saw A Chorus Line before it opened on Broadway. When I came to do The Innocents, it was in previews across the street.
Play, when you came
Correct.
To do, right.
And A Chorus Line, and I went to the previews.
Before it opened.
Before it opened.
Before it became like the biggest hit of the time.
Yeah, my parents got tickets. And I was like,
they sure
I mean,
loved
that was
you.
A
they,
seminal.
They love theater as much as you?
They love it. They love it. They love it. So that song became my song, but then it was like, controversial that I sang that because there's a line she says, except the feeling that this bullshit was absurd. And I sang that in my audition. Anyway,
for Annie. Did you belt it out? Were you like,
I wasn't really a belter.
Right.
Before I got Annie, I did a show at the Manhattan Theater Club with Charles Strauss, who wrote the music and the lyrics, right?
For Annie. Yeah.
And Martin Sharnan directed that show.
Yeah.
And it was a review of Charles Strauss's music.
Uh-huh.
So I'd had that experience. Then I came over, I auditioned for Annie. I got the part. And when I got the part of July, the orphan, some might say it's the most boring orphan, but I liked her.
Yeah.
They said, also, you're now going to be the understudy to Annie because Andrea is going to leave. the original Annie, is going to leave. When she leaves, Shelley Bruce is moving up into the role of Annie.
Yeah.
And we need an understudy. But before that happens, Sarah Jessica, Shelley's going on vacation. When Andrea, like when you come into the show, Shelley will be on vacation. You have to learn Annie first. Because if Andrea doesn't make it, you're first up on deck.
Because the understudy's on vacation.
She's on holiday.
Right.
So
this is one of those like, and then
you get a week of rehearsal. Yeah. You get a week of rehearsal.
Yeah.
They taught me Annie first.
Mm-hmm.
They taught me my track for July. Opening night, January of 1978, biggest snowstorm in New York City in 36 years. All those people in the cast, they all live in Philly, including Andrew McArdle. She's not going to make the show. Literally, they're like, you might be going on and playing Annie. I was like, what? What the fuck?
Yeah.
But I didn't care. I was like 12. I was like, okay, where's, tell me where to go. Tell me what to do. Anyway, she got there in time, but a bunch of other people were out. We had to kind of reorganize the show. Eventually.
There was an audience? They came?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Come on, New Yorkers.
Yeah, right.
You know, if you have tickets, find a way.
Yeah.
Anyway, did the show, did it for a while. Then one of the original cast members, a grown-up who played a very pivotal role of Grace Farrell, that's kind of ingenue lead opposite Daddy Warbucks, was leaving. And anytime an original cast member leaves, the whole creative team comes back to watch and send them off. Shelley, by then Annie, was out sick. I was on. So I did the show in front of all the creative team.
Yeah.
And they came back and they were like, you're going to be Annie. I was like, all right.
Come on.
I was like, no, really. I was like, all right.
Yeah.
And I had auditioned for a TV series, and I got the part. But I got the part when my parents were out of town. My oldest brother was taking care of us. And I said to them, listen, I'm going to give you my notice. I'm leaving. Martin Charnin came back, and he was like, you're one day shy of a 2-week notice. And I was like, come on. Really?
Yeah.
And he's like, stay and I'll make you Annie. And I was like, can I get that in writing? Because I don't believe you. And he did.
So, do you know what that
TV
show was?
So I took over.
Did it?
It was called Me and Max.
So it didn't even, did it run?
I don't think it ran terribly long, but it was good. Mm-hmm. It was the guy that created Welcome Back, Kotter.
Right.
James Comeck, I think was his name.
It's interesting about TV, though, because like you're a real theater person.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing more satisfying than that. The immediacy of that, the connection with the audience.
Yeah.
I mean, I can tell you telling the story. It's one of the greatest stories you have.
Yeah, it's a good story.
No, but like you can feel it.
Yeah, yeah.
The excitement of that and of theater in general.
Yeah, because nothing can mimic it. Nothing.
Right.
And I love television. I love the speed and the immediacy and the limitations and the urgency and all of it.
But it's a different type of acting.
But it's a very different type. And it's a different kind of rigor and discipline.
Sure.
But I do remember laying in bed the night before I took over the role. I played this orphan for a year, and then I played Annie for a year. And I remember lying in bed, and I shared a bedroom with my sister, and I was thinking to myself, looking at the ceiling like, I gotta play that part for a year.
Right.
Yikes.
Right.
I'm almost like 15.
Right.
I should maybe be in high school now. Maybe I shouldn't be playing Little Orphan Annie.
Right.
But I knew this was, you know, an opportunity. And actually the other day I was.
And it's a living too, right?
It's a living. I was contributing to my family, you know, and it was important. So, and
I
loved it.
Is that how it worked? Was it like, how did that work with, you know, your father being the type of person he is when you had those kind of conversations, you being probably the biggest breadwinner of the family at that point?
Maybe I was.
But was there sort of like, we're going to put this away for you, and then, you know, this is going to...
I think we put it away, but we also, if we needed it, we used it. And
right.
that was just an understanding. I mean, it was interesting because we didn't talk about it, but we talked about it.
Right.
It was made clear that we were contributing because the family was contributing to us.
Right.
And my brother, when I was doing Annie on Broadway, he was doing Runaways on Broadway. He was, you know, the Elizabeth Suedos show, Runaways.
Yeah.
It was a musical. So he was in that original cast. So he and I, when I was first doing Annie, we were living on Roosevelt Island. And we would meet and take the N and the R train back home.
Mm-hmm.
So he was, you know, contributing as well. But I never had any resentment about that. And even though when I left home... And I was, you know, almost 18, and I had by then done Square Pegs.
How long was that on a season?
That was only a season. I had a, I didn't have.
Were you living in L.A.? Did you live in L.A.?
I lived at the Oakwood Garden Apartments on Cahuenga.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You
where
know?
They put people up who don't live there. And
yeah.
Furnished apartments.
Like a lot of the divorced.
Yeah.
Like recently divorced yeah. men. Uh-huh. Ugh. God, it was really bleak. I didn't care. It really depressed me.
You were like 18?
I was 16, 17.
So who was there with you?
My mom. And two siblings, yeah.
In Hollywood, there you
go. On Cahuenga? Yeah, is that Hollywood?
I think it's over the hill. So
it's
like
Toluca Lake.
Yeah, right, exactly.
I found it really...
How could a furnished apartment situation
really
be
depressed me.
Happy?
Yeah, I didn't care for it.
But how long did you stay in Hollywood or in L.A.?
So I did a season of television of that.
Yeah.
Went back home, did Footloose after that.
That was a big thing, yeah.
That was a big thing. And then by then I was 18 and on my own.
And starting to want to be in movies.
Yeah, and I had done a bunch of movies by then anyway, like smaller parts.
Right.
And so, I mean, I was a journeyman. I was happily a journeyman. I thought I had the world on a string. I mean, I had the career I imagined was, and still believe, is the best possible career.
You
which
worked.
Is, I was working, and I was working in film, and then I was working in television, and then I was working in theater, and then I was able to pay my bills. And
no real disappointment about one thing not happening?
No.
You were a working actress, and
I was trying to get
parts.
Jobs that I was proud of, and work that I was excited about, and people that I wanted to work with. That was, if I could pay my bills, and I could eat, and I could take the subway and get a slice of pizza.
It's great.
What more...
Yeah.
What more? Honestly, what more could I want?
And you've been in the public eye for a long time. I mean, like, you dated Robert Downey before it fell apart for him in a big way.
Yeah, I was with him for 8 years.
You were a kid, though.
I know.
Like, how old were you? Like 19.
We were 18. We met when we were 18.
Where'd you meet?
On Firstborn, a movie called Firstborn with Terry Garr and Peter Weller.
Yeah, he's like an astoundingly talented man. That guy.
Yeah, yeah, he is.
But you were with him like you were just kids. But you saw that, you must have seen that it was like going to be a struggle.
I didn't, you know, I'd never seen drugs, done drugs, been around drugs, even though Square Pegs turns out was riddled with drugs, which I didn't know at all.
You were Annie.
I think I was naive. I wasn't innocent, but I was naive. And I didn't recognize things that maybe somebody who had dabbled in that world would know as signs. But I also felt, I think like a lot of us do about a lot of things, which is like, well, I can deal with that.
Sure.
I can fix that. I can help.
And it's also
once
the time,
I,
too. Like that time, it was sort of like, we're all doing it.
Oh, my Everyone's God.
Doing,
it was
crazy.
It was everywhere. It was everywhere.
Sure.
And we weathered a huge amount of that. But eventually I felt that, I guess I just summoned the courage to leave him and not... The biggest, hardest choice about those kinds of relationships is feeling brave enough to leave, even if you're afraid they're going to die. Like that's because you stay, not because you're in love anymore. You love this person and you're afraid that they will die if you aren't there to shore up their base every single solitary day.
Did you do any sort of work like Al-Anon, codependent?
You know, I tried at one point because he went to, you know, we did like, you know, many interventions and everyone was like, you should go to Al-Anon meetings.
Yeah.
And I went to some Al-Anon meetings and I remember coming home and saying to him, gosh, you know, Downey, they seem so angry. I'm not angry. I'm worried. I'm not angry.
And you're young, too.
And I
so
felt,
young.
Yeah, and I wasn't, you know, tired of it yet. Mm-hmm. I was just didn't want him to die. Like, I just didn't want him to die.
Right.
And, we're friends still. It's it's kind of great.
Well, it's a great sort of success story with him, you know, because, you know, I'm sober and, you know, he seems to be holding
I didn't
the line.
That. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
For how long are you sober?
17 years.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's real.
Yeah. And, you know, we have some common friends. And I'm just like, I'm impressed when people can, especially going through what he went through, because it seems that right after you broke up. And also, I guess you were really, this was your home, New York.
Yeah.
So that made
it. I came
it,
home.
Yeah, a little easier or harder. I don't know what. But, like, it seemed like right after you guys broke up, that was when he was like.
Yeah. It was mad.
And I imagine you just had to sit there and go, like, I hope, you know.
It was weird. I did sort of, although I got pulled back in later. In a way that was very dark and scary.
What does that mean?
I guess it just means I got off a plane in Los Angeles, you know, and I, you know, there have been some years spent not together. Yeah. And I got off, and, you know, you would go to the luggage thing, and, you know, I had a flip phone at the time, like a, what would be the brand, you know.
Samsung
like,
or
no,
or
like no. The only brand at the time.
Oh, I don't know.
You know,
what was,
what was it
yeah.
called? Whatever. Oh, Jesus, God, that's so sad. Anyway, the one I always wanted, I had it.
Yeah.
And I flipped it open, and there were, like, you know, 100 messages. And they were all like, did you hear about Downey, Downey, Downey? And a lot of people calling me saying, can you help? Can you step in and help?
What had happened?
He disappeared.
Oh.
And it was that really bad
like he was
public
on the run.
Chapter.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he was on the run. And I was pulled back in, and I'm not certain why. But anyway.
You found
yeah,
him?
Yeah, it's hard. Yeah. Yeah.
You were the one.
I was working with some other people.
Right, right.
But it was, I had not seen him that bad. He was never that bad when we were together.
Right.
And it's like a muscle that atrophied, and then it's like you're working it out again, and it just comes back. And
devastating, I guess.
Yeah.
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 And then you guys got him into treatment, I guess, again.
Yeah, I mean, I think that wasn't the end. I think there were a couple more.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
But yeah, I'm thrilled for his health and well-being now.
But what did you learn for yourself in that moment where you're like, that all came back so quickly, that it was as dangerous to you in a way?
It felt more dangerous to me than it had ever felt.
Right.
It felt like it had entered a sort of an alternate universe of really scary associations and really scary a habit that had become genuinely scary, but everything around it too was dangerous. It was it was who was he communicating with, how was he you know, conducting this business, who was in his life, and how often was he putting himself
in danger,
in true, like, and
when you're
me
doing it,
putting me in danger, and
just
asking
with the people in these situations,
terrifying, and I guess what I learned is that I had a real allergy to it all of a sudden. Like, I really found, like, it made me sick to my stomach.
Right.
And it made me so sad. Mm-hmm. Like, I couldn't get over how sad it was. Because it was a very different kind of relationship with drugs then.
Right.
Now.
Sure.
Versus, that was like...
Since you were kids.
Like, innocent. That would be like champagne to, chasing the dragon is like...
Right, yeah. Well,
even though, I mean, that really the leap, but... So it was, you know,
you were scared.
Yeah, I was I was really, like, I set up a whole system of, like, being in touch with people the whole time and pretending that I was calling in for my call time because I was shooting a movie at the time.
Oh,
and
you,
like,
got really sucked in.
I mean, I was so scared. I was scared.
Yeah.
But I was scared for him, too. But, you know.
You're all right.
Yeah, I'm fine. He's good.
And
he's,
you learned
well.
A big lesson that it's not, you can't save somebody.
No, you can't.
That's
you can't.
It's an important lesson.
And and every time you think you're special, like, every time you're like, I know he's difficult. Like, a girl that's like a boyfriend that's coming with all these warning signs, just, you're like, no. Just like, give me 2 weeks of them. No.
Not your job.
No.
Well, that's a good lesson to learn.
It's very good.
It seems like you got some extreme training in it very quickly.
Yeah, it was like a master class.
I mean, it's nice that you're still friends.
Yeah, we are. It's very nice.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
All right, so let's just go through. I love this. So Sex and the City. We're at a point in time where But I imagine, though, like, having worked as long as you had and done movies and done everything else, and even though you say that, you know, you were just a journeyman and everything else, this was probably a break that you didn't anticipate would be as big as it was.
Correct.
And it was spectacular.
Yeah, it was.
You know,
from beginning to end. I mean, the experience itself was spectacular.
Yeah.
It was. I did the pilot, never thought about it again, like you do.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody on a street stopped me, said, "Hey, I saw your show." And I was like, "What show?" She said, "You did a pilot." And I was like, I literally don't remember what she's talking about.
Yeah.
She said, "Sex and the City." I was like, "Oh, you saw that? I haven't seen it."
Right.
She was like, "Oh, it's good." And I was like, "Oh, okay." Then it got picked up, and then I became panicked and tried to get out of it.
Really?
I really tried to get out of
it. Why? Because you want to do movies?
I was like, well, I got it all now. I can do a play this month, and then I can run, do a part in a movie. And then I
need to be strapped to it.
Right, because in my head, there was like, you were on a thing, and it was 7 years, and then everything was the same every day, and that terrified me. And I talked to my agents, and anyway, I'm so grateful, but they, you know, talked me out of my panic, and I went to the set the very first day. We were shooting on Bleecker Street and 6th Avenue. Never looked back.
Yeah.
There wasn't one day that I didn't want to be on that set. Not one single day that I didn't think doesn't get better than this.
Oh, it's great.
Yeah, it was the experience of a lifetime for a lot of reasons.
It changed, not only did it change TV in a way, but it changed the city, mm-hmm. and it gave a lot of people a sort of, you know, an outlet of glamour that had not existed before, and it integrated communities around.
Yeah, and I think
women,
it was about like hopes. Yeah. I mean, it was an idealized, heightened version of what this city could promise.
Right. Yeah.
But I think the thing that I loved most was the storytelling. Was the clothes were fun and titillating language salty, and the city looking all sparkly. Mm-hmm. But Michael Patrick King's writing and being able to live a life that long, literally another person who gets to have all these really sort of very colorful, very erratic heartbeat. Like that kind of is, with his words.
Yeah. Great.
A dream. Yeah.
You know, what's amazing to me right now with you is that, you know, I've watched some, you know, I've seen Sex in the City. You know, I was not like, oh my God, it's on.
No, that's, that's cool. It's cool. It's cool.
No, but like.
Not like I was with Air America, for instance.
Right, in the mornings with me yelling about things.
Yeah.
But.
Do you miss any of,
Oh God, no.
What, meaning,
to be untethered from that dialogue day to day, like every day of that, and how, you know, like no matter what I feel in terms of what's going on or about politics, is that, you know, my revelation when I started the podcast was that, you know, existential challenges are what we all share.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as you start talking about politics, very, very rarely are you speaking exactly your own mind. You're going to toe a party line of some kind or another.
Yep.
And that in and of itself is divisive. I mean, people know my politics, but there's people who do it better than me. So why don't I just talk about, you know, the difficulties of day-to-day life as opposed to like the tone
but
of
in
me
this particular
talking about, I do it on stage
election
and I have done it a bit on the show.
Seat cycle.
Yeah.
It
is a responsibility.
So
on the stand-up stage I'll do a bit. You know, I do some.
And like you're doing some on what? Say it's tonight on Trump,
the nature of what the American president's responsibility really is, what qualifies someone to be that, what is driving people to vote for one or the other,
mm-hmm.
having a certain amount of empathy for people who I think are making the wrong decision,
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
trying to understand that, and also realizing that, you know, it's rare that these people are great people all the way through.
And
we just had one that was really good, and people seem to dismiss that. So like
because
if I'm not a little bit diplomatic, if I get strident, I don't even like my tone. I've been on stage recently where I'm like, I don't even like my tone.
Right.
It's annoying me.
No, I understand.
But what I was going to say is that, like, when I see you, you know, in a movie, like, you know, I saw that, like, recently on TV, the Bruce Willis movie came on with it, you know, on the boat and stuff. Like, no, but like, but
Striking Distance.
Right. But like, I just identify you as you. Like, when I see you in the show Divorce, you know, I'm not thinking like, no, Carrie Bradshaw. You know, like, I don't have that.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You, to me, transcend the character, which is a beautiful thing.
Thank you. That's nice to hear. That's a great relief.
And it was great talking to you.
Thank you. Likewise. It was a dream. A dream come true. Seriously. Like, I told you in the lobby I should repeat it for your millions and millions of listeners, but I'm just massive, massive admirer.
Oh, well,
so it's a total, and I will not ask for more. I will simply say officially make it, you were on the record inviting me to the garage, to speak, but to look.
But on,
correct?
But on mic, you can look on mic.
Look on mic, look on mic.
I think that we should do that. When
that's
you come
a cool
here.
Thing, actually.
Sure.
For a show.
Sure.
Look on mic.
Look on mic.
Instead of WTF, it could be look on mic.
Well,
like another
a spinoff.
Yeah.
Yeah. But what is this thing you did? Like, because I'm about to do a thing, the genealogy thing, because I was poking around on Wikipedia.
Who do you think you are?
Yeah, yeah.
It was amazing.
But like, because you found out a lot of stuff.
Found out a lot of stuff. Yeah. I mean, stuff that I thought we were newcomers to this country. I thought I had no connection. I thought I was a mutt, which I was fine and very actually.
But now it's a very defined mutt.
I'm not a mutt.
Okay.
Oh no no no!
Well, thank God.
My family on my mother's side got here 12 years after the Mayflower.
So it's
we were on the map. My family.
And you can find all that shit.
Yes, it's real.
Because I'm doing one. I'm doing a gene. They did my. I, they took
when
my
are you?
Spit.
Oh, you're doing that one.
Yeah.
Well, I can't wait to hear who you are.
Me neither.
I hope you're not disappointed. I had some concerns about who I might be.
But it sounded like you won. You hit the ancestry lotto.
I did. I mean, yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Anyway, right. Well, thank you. Oh, my God. You. Thank you.
Do you feel good about it?
Yeah, I feel very sated, like a good meal was just had.
Well, then, great. Me too. Good luck with the show.
Thanks, man.
Lovely. Lovely. There's just some people that are just, they're everything you think they are, and their charisma, and I love talking to Sarah Jessica Parker. I'm going to play two chords over and over again for a minute.
Boomer lives.